to Day On Against the Grain. Much has been written about the 1960s. What can we, what should we make of the 70s? Were revolutionary hopes extinguished, or did something constructive and inspiring take place? I'm CS. Political theorist Michael Hart helps us rethink the 70s, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. According to Michael Hart, the movements of the 60s, about which so much has been said and written, belong to a past world, whereas the 1970s mark the beginning of our time. Why does he say this in his book, The Subversive 70s? For one thing, neoliberal policies, policies that still hold sway today, originated in the 70s. For another thing, revolutionary struggles of the 70s should be viewed, he argues, as initial experiments to challenge contemporary structures of power and to chart paths toward liberation. Thus, Hart writes, "My aim is to use the 70s as a vantage point from which to see more clearly what liberation movements can be and can do today." Michael Hart teaches political theory in the literature program at Duke University. He is co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy and Assembly. His new book is The Subversive 70s. When Michael and I connected recently, I asked what he meant by the book's opening assertion that the 1970s was a decade of subversives.
Well, in some sense, I'm doing the kind of reappropriation of the term. You know, the subversive was used as the key to repression throughout the 70s in a variety of areas. You know, not only were militant workers subversives or any other sorts of militants, feminists, queers were subversives, et cetera. And so this is in some ways a kind of reappropriation. But I guess I also want to take the term seriously, you know, and own it in the sense of thinking subversives as those who were both challenging and eroding or even toppling the ruling order, but also constructing alternatives. Like that's the way I'm thinking of subversion here, which somehow forms a category for the very disparate movements in different countries that I'm trying to consider.
Right. So you did not want to look at only movements that sought to dismantle and or overthrow the system, social structures of domination. And did you find that a difficult project, or were really most of the movements you encountered or you remembered or you thought about including had that kind of double sense of subversive, in other words, at the same time constructing bases and foundations for liberation?
I do think that double nature is common to them. I mean, in the same way that that we might say today with the widespread discourses of abolition, that abolition in most of the instances means and should mean really that it's not only about abolishing, but also about constructing social alternatives for it. I think that's a common thread that goes through. So the movements that I became interested in, you know, in the 1970s, revolutionary movements, I guess by nature, have that project of the construction of another world.
Many accounts have been written about the 1970s, and it seems like part of the project of your book is to push back against some of the standard accounts. And I think one way in which you examine the terrain is to see how standard historical accounts juxtapose or compare the 70s to the 60s. What have you found? What is the rather typical portrayal of those two decades in relation to each other?
It is inevitable when talking about the 1970s to contrast them to the 60s. I think that's so often done in a popular cultural memory, also in certain historical forms. And so, I mean, in one sense, the memory of the 60s is often cast in a purely virtuous way and rather uncomplicated. You know, we get images of the dignified walkers across the Selma Bridge or also anti-war protesters giving out flowers to soldiers or something like that. I mean, I think that there's a lot involved in that in a whitewashing of the 60s, you know, both the repression under which the movement suffered, but also the radicality of the movements. The 70s, however, are much more complicated. In some sense, that's one of the things that I find more interesting or useful for us. And let me come back to that in a minute, but I also wanted to mention, and I think this is something I'm working throughout the book, is to recognize where the 70s are really part of our own contemporary, you know, like that our present era begins in the 70s. So however wonderful and important, and certainly were revolutionary movements of the 60s, they really belong to the past, where the 70s is part of our own. I would say that, I mean, one way of recognizing that is in terms of the forms of power developed in the 60s. Think of all the studies about neoliberalism beginning, you know, often talking about it beginning in 1973 with the coup in Chile, or in the late 70s with Thatcher and then Reagan. So in some ways, you could say that the forms of domination that we face today are begun in the 1970s. But I would find more important, and this is what I'm trying to work through, is that the political problems that the revolutionary movements recognized are still our problems. And in fact, the way I would say it is that on the one hand, we can see, and this is maybe the more direct, but maybe for that less interesting mode, which is that we can see, you know, like the seeds or embryo of what have developed into our current forms of protest or activism or revolutionary activity, when it is that we can see that as having begun then. You know, we can recognize, I don't know, let's say the formation of affinity groups in the anti-nuclear protests in New Hampshire or something like that. And then we can see the affinity groups formed in Occupy Wall Street, something like that. But more interesting to me is the other side of it, which is, I think in some ways it's not that we're ahead of the 70s, like we're a development of the 70s, that there are other ways the revolutionary movements at that time were really ahead of us and we need to catch up to them. That's what I find more interesting. So both of those are in that framework, like I was saying, of recognizing the 70s as being the beginning of our era, and hence these revolutionary movements of the 70s is the first attempt to confront and to overthrow the forms of domination under which we still find ourselves.
I want to point to your proposal in this book, The Subversive 70s, by my guest Michael Hart, to interpret the progressive and revolutionary movements of the 1970s, or at least many of them, in terms of their concepts. What do you mean by that?
Well, I would start from a simple, maybe obvious recognition that there isn't just a division of labor whereby intellectuals think and activists act. Instead, there is a lot of theoretical work that goes on in collective social movements. And so my way of accounting for that, for the kind of theorizing that goes on collectively in movements, which I'm saying is equally valuable, although not done in a different register, often in different idioms than the kind of intellectual theoretical discourse, that the movements themselves produce concepts. So what I'm trying to do is to recognize and to learn from the concepts that were produced in the movements, even sometimes if the movements themselves are not using those terms. It's my way of attaching to and understanding the kind of theorizing they were doing. It also allows me to recognize the continuity among the movements, you know, so that things going on in Iran and going on in Nicaragua at the same time, even if there isn't direct communication between them, that they are in some sense working through the same concepts. Or in South Korea and in Detroit, I mean, so that even when you don't have the same, you know, sometimes there are actual communication, reading about what's happening, even actually activists going to the different areas, but sometimes there isn't, and there's still the development on the same concepts. And so that allows me to recognize certain international and sometimes even global continuities of what the movements were doing at the time.
At the beginning of your book, you point to four concepts, although you acknowledge there are many others one could investigate. The four are autonomy, multiplicity, democracy, and liberation. Rather than have you discuss them individually and in somewhat maybe abstract terms, we could turn to one of the arenas of struggle that you address in this book, and that has to do with Italy in the 1970s, because this brings out, I think, a number of developments that you frame in conceptual terms, including some of the terms that I just mentioned, that I just listed. Maybe we could begin where you begin this chapter, with a strike or strikes at Fiat, the auto company Fiat, in Italy. And actually, this was in 1969, leading up to what was called the hot autumn of that year. What did those strikes at Fiat involve and, in a sense, foretell?
Well, first, one of the things one has to recognize about industrial labor activism in the 1970s in Italy, but also in Germany, other European countries, and particularly in the US, is the intensity of worker struggle during that period, the intensity of industrial worker struggle, and the dangers that those workers' strikes and other forms of contestation posed for management and for capital. So in Italy, it was one example of an extremely strong industrial labor movement, one that, like I said, succeeded in posing a threat on a national level of what of the rule of capital and of the national social relations. And so what I'm most interested in this particular strike, and this is the way it was in fact interpreted at the time by activists, was that the strike at the Fiat was not isolated to the Fiat, and the workers did not stay in the factory, because the workers in this strike went out of the factory and took their march, essentially the corteo, the march of the workers moved outside of the factory and was joined by members of the community, and then there fought with police overnight in a large and sort of historic, like often remembered in Italy, battle. So what the interest here is, and I think this is the paradigm that it's important to recognize for the late 60s and early 70s in Italy and elsewhere, which is that the industrial worker was thought to be the center of the struggle for liberation, and that the workers could in fact lead social struggles more broadly. You know, so by exiting the factory, they made it clear that it was not just the struggle about workers' conditions, but it was also the struggle about housing in the community, about other social issues, and it gave a kind of content and specificity to the possibility of the workers, industrial workers, acting in the interests of an entire social movement.
Michael Hart, H-A-R-D-T, teaches political theory in the literature program at Duke University. We are talking about his new book, The Subversive 70s. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Two revolutionary parties were created in Italy in the late 1960s, Workers' Power and Continuous Struggle, and these are the translations, of course, of the Italian. You're right that one of them, Continuous Struggle, or Lotta Continua, I'm sure I'm butchering that, wanted to move from a limited conception of the working class to a broader notion of the proletariat. A broader notion to include what?
Well, like I said, with the symbol of that Fiat strike, you know, that the industrial worker struggle was not just about the factory, you know, it's not just about industrial workers, but that the industrial workers would be able to lead the larger struggle. You know, so one of the slogans of Lotta Continua, this continuous struggle, the party you're mentioning, was, let's take the city, prendiamoci la città, That was the Italian version. I mean, so the idea there is about the metropolitan space, you know, rather than the factory itself, being the site of struggle. You know, giving the idea that it's a social battle, it's a social struggle, and that class struggle has the power to lead other social struggles. Now, I should point out that, you know, one thing that's important for me. I mean, I guess two aspects are extremely important for me. Like I mentioned, first one is the intensity and the power of these worker struggles at the time. But the second is that despite the fact, like you're pointing out, that this party is interested in the way that the worker struggle also engages other social struggles, they still maintained in this period, late 1960s, early 1970s, they still maintained the centrality of the industrial worker to the revolutionary struggle more generally, you know, so that the industrial worker still functioned as the protagonist, and the factory, while connected to to society or the city more largely, was still the center of the struggle. And that's what, you know, that's something that I think is going to change, you know, that I read as changing in the course of the 70s, but it's worth my emphasizing there at the beginning.
You point to two concepts here, you know, your conceptual analysis comes to the fore here as well as in many other places, two concepts that served as guiding principles among radical workers and far left political groups from the early 60s onward. One was the refusal of work. What did this mean to Italian radicals?
The refusal of work was a widespread concept within the workers' movement at the time, and it didn't mean the refusal of work in the sense of, like, I don't know, lying on the couch, you know, the refusal of productivity, the refusal of activity. It rather means the refusal of the hierarchical and unfree conditions that we have at work. A classic example of the refusal of work is the labor strike itself, but it takes many other forms: absenteeism, sabotage, dragging your feet on the job. I mean, these are ways of refusing work. And for them, see, the other thing we should contrast it with is that left and communist notion in certain circles of the affirmation of work, you know, as if proletarian struggle or communist struggle or progressive struggle means celebrating work, and that workers are the example, like, you know, are always working harder. Now, I mean, I think that this is a equally revolutionary, or maybe more effectively revolutionary attitude, and one that workers, industrial workers, other workers have always had. You know, the thing that I feel like people quickly get confused about it is to think of it as just like refusing to work or being lazy. Yeah, there you could, or something like that. It's rather a refusal of domination, the domination that's contained in work, so that it functioned as a overarching concept, and then had very specific ways it came to be applied, like I'm saying in the labor strike.
And a second concept was workers' autonomy, which was taken to mean what?
So in some sense, that the notion of workers' autonomy in these years in Italy derived from first the notion of the union's autonomy from they were posing their autonomy from the political party, you know, that the union should be able to decide for itself. Workers' autonomy is one step further and then became a much broader application, which is that the workers themselves are capable of deciding, you know, deciding over their bargaining relations, about their strikes, about work conditions, so that it's a refusal of allowing the labor union to act as a representative that is not paying attention to the demands of the workers themselves. So in some sense, you could say that autonomy is really a question about the democracy of the workplace and the democracy of organizing. You could also say that it's a demand for participation rather than representation, you know, rather than understanding the union as a centralized decision-making structure which will represent the interests of the workers. The organizing principle has to be one in which the workers themselves are the authors and capable of decision making in all of their decisions. So in one, also maybe in a different frame, it means, you know, that the working class can be autonomous from capital on the one hand, but it also can be autonomous from the established and centralized union structures.
So a sort of worker militancy occurred in 1973 in Italy, where Fiat workers occupied several plants in Turin for 3 days. So I think a lot of people would say, wow, that's radical. That is moving and shaking the terrain and advancing a kind of struggle, indicating to capital, to management, to factory bosses that, you know, workers are not willing to participate in what's going on, in collaborating with the forms of domination occurring within the factory, and also perhaps with what they might have seen as their unions, the established unions, collaborating to a degree with management. And yet, your collaborator, Tony Negri, thought differently. What did he think of what happened, this occupation of auto plants?
Yeah, Tony certainly wasn't alone at the time in reading it this way. I think that the comparison with the 1969 strike that you mentioned is prominent in people's minds. So that, as I said, what was so much celebrated in 1969 was the fact that the workers went outside the factory and linked their struggle with social struggles in the city, in the social terrain, let's say. In 1973, it was an extremely widespread and powerful strike among many plants and of workers for many days, like you said, but they closed themselves inside the factory and did not connect with social struggles. So it was, in a way, it closed off the factory space from the social terrain. Now, I think much was made of this at the time, and I'm making much of it too. In some ways, it's a symptom, you know, and symbolic of a transformation, a more general transformation that was happening, you know, so that the increasing power, in some sense, of the worker militancy, but on the limited terrain and not in connection with other social struggles.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Hart joins us. He teaches at Duke University. He's co-author with Tony Negri of the Empire Trilogy, and most recently, Assembly. And we are talking about his new book. It's called The Subversive 70s. We have a link to that book and to Michael's faculty page at Duke on our website, againstthegrain.org. So there was tangible success in terms of workers' struggles in the late 60s and early 70s in Italy. How did Italy's ruling elites, political and economic elites, react to this?
In Italy, and this is something we should be familiar with in the U.S. too, capital responded, you know, first of all, with fear. You know, the notion of that the factories were becoming ungovernable. This is what, you know, was common in the great industrial centers in Italy, as in Germany and the U.S. too. And their response, and you could say an intelligent response, was to try to destabilize the basis of industrial worker power. And that was done by restructuring the industrial base. You know, this is something we're quite familiar with, I think, and is thought of in general as the tragedy of the 1970s from, you know, on a certain left, which is that through automation, through exporting industrial production and other means, this is what I mean by the restructuring of the industrial base, so that the possibilities, you know, that the material possibilities, you know, of workers, of industrial workers to organize and have this power were destroyed. And that's the content, I think, of a certain narrative of defeat that runs through our cultural memory of the 1970s. You know, that was the moment when unions and workers were defeated by capital by transforming factories and transforming industrial production. This was done in Italy, say, around 1973, 1975. These were years also in which there was economic crisis around the oil embargo and other economic indicators of capital, but it's mostly, I think, and this is what was really prominent mostly in the minds of managers, was finding a way to undermine the power of industrial workers. And like I say, they were very successful in transforming factories in ways that undermine the basis of that worker organization.
So if the response by capital in the form of things like automation and outsourcing of labor, if that had an impact, and it did, on the industrial working class in Italy and the centrality of the industrial working class in struggle, in social struggle, in political struggle, economic struggle, what impact did that have on the two concepts you talked about earlier, the refusal of work and workers' autonomy?
Yeah, in my view, I think we have to view that industrial transformation, and like you said, the end of the centrality of the industrial worker within struggles for liberation more generally, we have to view that in a double way, I suppose. I mean, on the one hand, it was a powerful arm of attack against what had become an extremely powerful threat to capitalist production and the social order. On the other hand, it forced even, but also provided the basis for a reorganization of social struggles. I mean, the centrality of the industrial worker to struggles is something that I think we can commonly see in retrospect was to the detriment of many social struggles. I mean, it was of course powerful in one sense, but this is exactly what for many years posed class struggle and even a narrow band of class struggle, the struggle of industrial workers, as primary, and other struggles, even if important, as secondary to that. So in these parties of previous years and for decades, of course they would say, yes, women's oppression is important and we will pose the women question, or racial oppression is important and we'll have a race question, but still with the idea that the industrial worker and his, and primarily his struggle, is the central one. So that's why I'm saying in some ways we should view it not just as a curse, or not even primarily as a curse, but as a blessing, this reorganization of the industrial base of capital that forced or allowed for the possibility of reconceiving the priorities of struggles for liberation in such a way that the industrial working class no longer had priority as the primary figure of liberation. Not to mean, of course, you know, and I think that there's quickly a reaction when I say things like this, not to mean that class struggle was no longer important, and also not to mean that industrial class struggle was no longer important, but rather that they had to be conceived. This is what I recognize in Italy, and what I actually found so exciting about these tentative and partly successful developments in Italy, was to try to conceive the possibilities of revolutionary struggle in a way that both included class struggle, but also were extended beyond it, that necessitated the understanding of liberation struggles in a kind of network, of which class struggle was one part, but only one part, and not the central one, the only one.
Yeah, and so workers' autonomy, refusal of work, what happened as a result of these? Really, this seems like a big change in consciousness and ways of thinking about the situation.
Right. And I think those concepts, or way those concepts shifted, I think are symptoms of a more general attempt to shift. So that the refusal of work developed into a much larger concept that had not only to do with the refusal of industrial workers in the variety of ways I mentioned before, through strikes or absenteeism, etc., but a much more social tactic, a much more general tactic of refusal of authority, of refusal of disciplinary regimes, etc. So that the Italian militants started thinking of this in more general form that applied to other populations. For instance, some of the feminist movements at this time that were developing, you know, in reaction to the ways that they had been excluded from the male industrial workers movement. They adopted the notion of the refusal of work, but applied now to reproductive labor and to unwaged labor, you know, so that the part of feminist struggle would involve a refusal of work, but one that looked very different, you know, that had to do with unpaid domestic labor and other forms of reproductive labor. And then as progressively, the term is then also used, or the concept is used, in a much wider social frame. Similarly, with autonomy, the idea of constructing social circuits of aid and social forms that didn't appeal to either capital or the state or the other ruling institutions, but rather, like, so the construction, for instance, of autonomous social centers, which was something in Italy that developed nationally in those years, you know, which were in some sense a much more developed version of what were known as squats in other countries, you know, so the occupied buildings that provided both, you know, housing for people, but also places for social interaction and concerts and meetings for political purposes, etc. These were thought of as autonomous spaces, you know, autonomous spaces that could even prefigure the possibilities of an alternative social form, and it just allowed people to act different, you know, to live differently. You could see that as an example of autonomy being thought not only in the factory and not only for the working class, you know, either from capital or from the union, from other forms of authority, but a more general social project of autonomy.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Hart joins us. He is a professor of literature and a political theorist based at Duke University. His new book is The Subversive 70s. So from the whirlwind of theoretical and practical innovations that were emerging in Italy in the 1970s, emerged, as you write, a new form of political organization. That organization was Autonomia, which was not a political organization or a party, but a broad, heterogeneous social movement. So to what extent, Michael, did Autonomia want to bring its very diverse components together into a coherent movement? And if that was one of its missions, did it succeed in doing so?
It was often referred to at the time as an area, like the area of Autonomia, meaning that it was relatively dispersed or occupied a coherent terrain, let's say. They also thought of it as a network or a galaxy sometimes, you know, so there was this notion of constellations, maybe we should put it this way. So it didn't mean to form a coherent organization in the sense of a directed party, or it didn't have a oversight or something like that. But rather, I think this is what I find interesting and inspiring about its attempts, was that it was based on the articulation among different groups. And, you know, like I'm hesitating a bit, because I think there was an intention of this that was somewhat successful, but the intention itself is already important. You know, so articulation among student groups, industrial labor groups, other forms of labor organizing, feminist groups, gay liberation groups, and the unemployed. I mean, so there was a wide array of social subjectivities, you know, even of organizational forms that were intended to be able to struggle in common, but not in any centralized, directed way. That seems to me quite inspiring. And I guess what I think I'd like to emphasize is, at least for me, I see this as a important response to the transformations of capital that we were talking about earlier, the restructuring of capital, the exporting of factories, the automation of factories, the destabilizing or the undermining of the central figure of the industrial worker. It seems to me that made possible and even made necessary this alternative form, which, like I say, doesn't exclude industrial labor and doesn't, it's also a way of trying to understand class struggle, but class struggle in articulation with a variety of other forms. That seems to me the most inspiring attempt of these movements in the mid and late 70s in Italy.
Let's turn to your discussion in this book, The Subversive 70s, to your discussion of the U.S. labor situation in the 1970s. And you choose to focus on, and I think for good reason, radical workers who, let's just put it this way, and you can certainly elaborate on this, did not fall in line behind the established dominant unions of the time. Is there any way to summarize what the source of dissatisfaction was on the part of radical workers with what the dominant unions were doing?
You know, one way to approach this before getting to the actual response to you is to say, you know, that I feel a continually present nostalgia for strong unions and in good factory jobs. Like that, as if that was what the past was, that somehow the present can regain. And so, you know, we might have other arguments about or discussions about, you know, whether that's possible. But one thing to recognize about the industrial worker movements that I'm focusing on in the 1970s in the United States is they hated factory discipline and they hated the centralized unions and fought the union often for obviously good reasons. I mean, sometimes just in terms of corruption. Okay, that's maybe the less interesting part. The more, I think, central part is around questions of democratic organizing. I mean, so that centralized unions as institutions that claim to represent the workers often didn't represent the workers, but the workers wanted something different. They wanted to participate in the decision-making process rather than be represented by others. So in some cases, you know, this becomes even more clear, and in the U.S. in particular, in racial terms. I mean, it's relatively well known, and it's a great example of this, is the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit. And the League was, you know, contesting the UAW. You know, they ran their own candidates, you know, and such, but they were contesting, you know, like not only the centralization of the UAW and the ways that it misrepresented them, but also that it was impermeable to their participation. And the racism of the union was in part what they were contesting. And I think that the anti-racist attempt on their part is important. I would link it though to other instances that workers were struggling against their unions for the undemocratic nature of the unions themselves. Here's maybe another generalized way of saying it, which is that to many of these workers, the unions seem much more on the side of management than on the side of workers. But that, I would say, is that's really just a secondary effect of the lack of democratic input and possibility of democratic participation of the workers themselves, and the workers believing that they themselves could represent themselves. You know, that they had the abilities to make decisions for themselves. So that this, like in Italy, this seems to me something that was quite parallel, was workers conducting a double struggle or a struggle on two fronts. You know, one is against the factory and against factory discipline and hence really against capital, but in the form of factory discipline, and at the same time a struggle against the unions that they felt betrayed by, but even that the unions took the wrong form, you know, that the unions were centralized decision-making structures that excluded their possibilities for participation.
You talked about in the Italian context, workers, radical workers, kind of making the system ungovernable. And then elites kind of understood this. Well, they must have understood it. And so then they reacted in certain ways, with really developments that constituted, in effect, a direct attack on the industrial worker. Is that what happened in the U.S. as well? Was there a sense on the part of capital in the United States that these radical workers are creating a situation in which business as usual could not continue?
Absolutely. And that's the way I understand. I mean, it's even a way of understanding the birth of neoliberalism from another perspective, maybe, which is that not only the factories had become ungovernable, but that the ungovernable factories risked making society ungovernable. So that the management literature of the time, the political literature of the time, these are some of the things that I cite. Even the famous Samuel Huntington report about democracy from 1975 were all about this problem of ungovernability, you know, of which I think the industrial workers were a prime protagonist. And what they were trying to think of were ways to make society and the factories too, to return them to the kind of discipline and governability that was required. So that the transformation of governing structures, I mean, I'm making a very large and approximate statement in this, the transformation of governing structures were a response to the threat posed by the workers and the factories. And so capital had to respond to that. That's more or less the general framework that I'm working with.
And do you think standard historical accounts of capitalist restructuring in the 1970s acknowledge to your satisfaction or to the proper extent, the extent to which radical workers did make capital restructuring necessary, as opposed to maybe other economic factors that have been brought to the fore in trying to establish what the causes of these momentous shifts in the operations of capital in the 1970s were?
Right. I think there's two things, interwoven things that you're pointing towards, at least the way I approach this historical question. I mean, there's one, like you're saying, I think that the dominant historical account, and I don't mean so much by historians, but our more general cultural understanding of it, which is to think of capital as the innovator, you know, that the capitalists thought and that they're the ones that generated the idea of transforming the economy, that they could make more money, they could, you know, have cheaper labor elsewhere, something like that, rather than seeing this as something initiated by the workers, which is in fact a sign of workers' power, and that capital is forced to restructure based on that threat. That's one aspect. And the second aspect that, like I say, I think goes with this is a common inherited sense we have at a popular cultural level. I mean, the historians' literatures would be a slightly different discussion. The sense of tragedy of this, you know, that it was the end of a kind of golden age of strong unions and good factory jobs, something like that. I think instead, maybe the two are linked, because once one recognizes that the power of organized industrial labor, and I mean organized industrial labor not necessarily within the established unions, but in other organizing structures too, that the power of industrial labor is what forces things, it helps us recognize, you know, not necessarily that the workers at the time got what they wanted, but that this is a story of their power. You know, that makes me look at it differently historically. It's not a story of the weakness of labor and of workers, but rather a story of their strength that then forces this change.
That's the voice of Michael Hart. His new book is The Subversive 70s. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. It cannot be denied that the capitalist restructuring of the 1970s, both in the US and globally, did a lot to counter, to confront, to, in a sense, snuff out a lot of the radical worker militancy of the 1970s. And you want to think beyond this notion of success and defeat, and certainly you can address that. But you also reflect on or think about in this book what would have been necessary for an adequate response to the restructuring of the capitalist system of the 1970s. What do you think would have constituted a more robust response such that maybe worker militancy and militancy in various other sectors of society might have survived or been more effective?
That's in part why I've been inspired by the Italian case. You know, it's only a part of the Italian, you know, radical movements, etc., that I'm referring to, and they were only partially successful in it. But what I'm inspired by is this attempt to transform that defeat into actually a victory. I mean, and the victory would be this: to recognize that centrality of the industrial worker, the figure of the industrial worker in struggles, was a problem. It was a problem from feminist perspectives, really is for problems from other forms of labor, from also from anti-racist perspectives. I mean, that we have to recognize that it was an opportunity. Yeah, let's put it that way. And so you were saying, what would be a positive response? I think a positive response would be, and this is the kind of things that we've been seeing in some sense, sometimes haltingly since then, which is to pursue class struggle under a key of multiplicity. I know that sounds a little bit overly complicated, by which I mean that it's not, when we think of class struggle, we think not only of the industrial worker, but of equally the wide range of worker struggles, you know, of service workers, of unpaid workers, of a variety of workers that way. So that would be victory to both transform class struggle into a internally multiple framework, you know, non-unified under the industrial worker. And then also think of that as multiple in the sense that class struggle is part of and has to be internally part of anti-racist struggle and feminist struggle and queer struggle, that these cannot be pursued and cannot be victorious without being articulated together. Like, that's what I think that this restructuring in the 1970s, that's the opportunity it forced on us. You know, maybe put it that way, you know, like, so, and it was one that wasn't grasped immediately in the US. Perhaps we've taken some decades to get there, but I would say that the most interesting and the forms of labor organizing today with the greatest potential are exactly organizing along these lines, along lines that are articulated with other struggles, you know, that recognize that a class struggle cannot not also be, you know, so it must be also an anti-racist struggle and a feminist struggle and a queer struggle, that has to be part of the paradigm. And that, so that the lack of centrality of the industrial worker in some ways opens the possibility for this transformation that seems to be necessary.
We've been talking about only a few chapters of this book, The Subversive 70s. Can you tell us about some of the other movements and struggles and developments that you address in this book?
Well, since we were just talking about it, there is of course, a section of the book that does try to think about these kinds of articulations among struggles, primarily conducted, this part was located primarily among feminists in the U.S., a sort of precursor for what later became known as intersectionality or intersectionality of struggles. In some ways, I think quite innovative in ways that can shift perhaps certain standard ways of thinking the intersectionality that came later. But then there's a wide variety of other things, you know, not only anti-racist struggles, say in the U.S. and South Africa and Britain, but also the different revolutionary projects that were so inspiring to people then, and I think could mean a lot for us today. You know, notions of popular power in Chile during the revolution there, in Portugal during the revolution there, in the anti-colonial struggles in Guinea-Bissau and Mozambique and Angola that were continuing in the 1970s. And I guess with all of this, partly what interests me most is that despite the geographical distance, there was common bases of struggle. And maybe the overarching one, and this is maybe the most inspiring thing for me, is that so many of these movements of the 1970s they had the audacity to demand liberation. And I think the audacity of their aims, not only the, you know, sort of blind belief in them, but the ability to construct projects towards liberation is what inspires me so much. I mean, I would say there's some ways, at least from a certain perspective, it seems like our ambitions have been downgraded you know, from Black Liberation to Black Lives Matter. I'm thinking of Kianga Taylor's book in that regard, or from worker liberation to $15 an hour, or from feminist liberation to gender equality, or gay liberation to equal marriage, something like that. I mean, I don't think this is completely true, but there are ways in which that audacity of demanding a radical transformation of our world is something that I profit from by going back to these movements and recognizing them. And I think that's something that's absolutely necessary today. You know, that when today we're facing such, it's seemingly intractable catastrophes, you know, climate catastrophe, the catastrophe of a spreading fascism or fascistic elements in the world. You know, it seemed a variety of ways in which it seems as if we're on the precipice, that these are moments, it seems to me, not for downgrading our demands and thinking in much smaller terms of retreating in defensive ways. I think these are exactly the moments when that kind of thinking big, or the audacious character of demanding revolution, demanding liberation, are absolutely necessary. So it's this that, I mean, that's maybe the overarching thing in the very different aspects of revolutionary movements in the 70s that impresses me so much and feels so vital to me now.
We've been talking about the book, The Subversive 70s. Its author, my guest, is the Duke University political theorist, Michael Hart, again, H-A-R-D-T. Michael, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
It's a pleasure talking to you again.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.